So in order to introduce Joanna, I am very excited to introduce Sean Kelly, who is a professor in the Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness Department here at CIIS. He is the author of Coming Home, The Birth of Transformation in the Planetary Era, and he has been co-teaching with Joanna Macy for 8 years. So please join me in welcoming Sean Kelly. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. So it's truly an honor to be introducing Joanna to you tonight. As most of you doubtless already know, she is a distinguished scholar and founding figure in the fields of deep ecology, eco-psychology, and religion and ecology, among others. But in the latter field, she is particularly noted for having worked out the deep resonances between the Buddha Dharma and the theory of living systems. She's also a seasoned and respected activist, most notably in connection with everything having to do with nuclear materials, or the poison fire, as she calls it, but more generally with all matters having to do with ecological integrity and social justice. Joanna is the author of many articles and 10 books, 13, I stand corrected, okay, including Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General Systems Theory, Coming Back to Life, which is the manual for the work that reconnects, a new edition having come out just recently, World as Lover, World as Self, also a new edition, relatively new edition came out not too long ago, Rilke's Book of Hours, Love Poems to God, co-translated with Anita Barrows, Widening Circles, a gripping, beautiful, elegant memoir, and really hoping that part two will come at some point. And most recently with Chris Johnstone, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. These are just the highlights. Joanna's been teaching here at CIS, actually other campuses, but at CIS since the 1980s, I believe. Where she is also a member on the Council of Sages. And over the past several decades, perhaps 4 decades now, at least 3, 4 decades, she has been traveling the world, offering workshops, giving lectures, touching the lives of many thousands, catalyzing them in their callings to resist the destructive onslaught of industrial growth civilization, and to find ways to create, to participate creatively in what she calls the great turning towards a life-sustaining society. Joanna's teachings help us understand how our pain for the world is a sign of a deeper health and sanity, how opening ourselves to the grief, anxiety, and rage at the current prospect of the unraveling of life itself is a gateway to an experience of our indissoluble solidarity with the entire Earth community, an invitation to awaken to our deeper identities as interbeings within this precious living Earth, in and through which or whom we have our being. To introduce Joanna fully to you, I would also need to call in all of our ancestors and even the future beings who, as the practices she has developed in her work that reconnects have allowed me to experience firsthand, are here to assist us in our time of need. I would need to introduce the 7 seas and the trade winds and the great circulation that courses through them, the Rocky Mountains in the Himalayan plateau, with their dwindling glaciers and rivers and creeks, the monarchs and geese in their troubled migrations, bear and salmon, whale and plankton, farmers and factory workers, protesters, slum dwellers, and prison inmates, and even, bodhisattva that she is, our troubled and troublesome 1%. In short, we would be here all night and still not be done with it. Without further ado, therefore, please welcome me join me in welcoming Joanna Macy.
Oh, that was the most beautiful introduction. Oh, with all the friends that we have, seen and unseen, there's so many people pulling with us in the work that we are engaged in for the ongoingness of life. I'm so proud to be here and as part of CIIS. I've been thinking that all day. The people gathered here in this our maiden voyage, I think, maybe not, but this conference was for, and I'll tell you more about it. And then I just went upstairs for something. I don't know. I was snooping around. And there was this wonderful native tribe of the Kustanoan Ohlone people dancing to ground their appeal to Pope Francis to not canonize Friar Junipero Serra. Anyway, so much is going on here, and one of the things that I love is that there are musicians here. And my friend Chris Giffen, I find, is here. And so I know that sound and music have so more important than spoken words. And so he has agreed to open and close my remarks. So where are you, dear?
Up here so my voice can be heard. I'm going to start with an original song called My Heart is Open. I've always thought that the landscape sung this song to me as I rolled through it. So start with My Heart is Open. This broad and open country I am growing, like the birthing leaves and blossoms, I am rich and I am deep, with love that gives and love that keeps me, ever swelling into all my life. Let hearts be open, like this broad and open country, let us grow here, like the greening trees and grasses, let's be rich and let's be deep, with love that gives and love that keeps us, ever dwelling at the heart of what will be. Are broken, they will find an open country yet unspoken, like the standing hills and mountains, they will stretch and they will weep, with love that holds and love that reaches, ever welling into hearts that will. Are deep with love that gives and love that keeps us ever swelling into all that life can be.
I was here today, and it was one of the most wonderful days for me. I attended every part of this conference except just one in the late afternoon when I needed, in my 85-year-old body, to go lay down. So I wish that Craig Chalquist were here tonight, because he organized this with this team, and it was a remarkable event. I felt so enriched. It is, I would have wanted him to hear my praises for what he has done, because I want this event to just be this conference on ecopsychology and its relevance to therapists and community leaders and educators. I want this to be bigger. I want it to be a whole weekend next time, and I want 10 times as many people, and I want it in a place where we can be outdoors, and I want it a space where we can do practical work. Don't you want that?
Yeah.
And it was so, although I spend so much of my waking hours thinking about this, to be in a group of people where it's openly addressed and talked about, what we're facing, the extraordinary situation in which we find ourselves now. Just as we are opening after 4 or 5 centuries of objectivist, dualistic, struggle, science versus religion, and all the extremely impoverished, soul impoverishing, but mentally exciting, I was about to say exhausting that too, centuries, we have come to a point again where we've circled back and recognize, as our indigenous brothers and sisters have been knowing all along, that we are part of a living part of the living body of the living earth. It's not just a resource for us. It's not just a supply house for our industrial machines and a sewer for our waste. It is our great mother. Or are we our great father, too? I'm always a little worried about over-feminizing the earth, considering how feminine beings are treated. But just at the moment when we are opening to this, and this institution has wonderful courses and professors that are known internationally for calling forth this recognition of our belonging to a living earth. Just as we're waking to this again, we are also taking in the fact that we're killing it. What an incredible, soul-twisting, gut-wrenching situation to be in. It breaks the heart. And it's a good thing to learn not to be afraid of the breaking heart. The heart that breaks open can hold it all. And to be in a group of people with great experience and political, intellectual discipline that I heard today here speak genuinely frankly, personally about this is a privilege for me beyond compare. This is what our people need. So I'm very, very grateful to be here. And I have learned so much that I didn't know before. So, Active Hope, it was called. And coming from, 38 years of specifically working on this psychic challenge, how to be with our world when this is befalling it and at human hands. As the title said, how not to go crazy with it, how not to shut down, how not to sink into shame. And I want to thank you for, Renee was helping us so brilliantly deal with the tendency and the fruitlessness of it to go into shame. We had two marvelous Renees here. And Renee Lertzman bringing us so much of her work over the last couple of decades in dealing with the many facets of taking apart this psychic numbing and what it consists of and how we can move beyond that. So it was called Active Hope, and I would like to give you the definition that my co-author and I came to in Active Hope in writing the book. My co-author, Chris Johnston of the United Kingdom, a wonderful physician and activist and facilitator and trainer in the work that reconnects. And it's simple. I mean, sometimes the simplest things are the best. Hope is not something that you have. It's something that you do. Simple, right? It's something that you do, and you do it in the action for a goal you want. And what is more whole-making than to work for the ongoingness of life on earth. And so if it's something you do, it doesn't depend on your psychic state at that moment. You can be knowing active hope and exercising it even when you're mired in hopelessness. Boy, do I like that. Because I'm so tired of this tendency in this culture for us to be constantly taking our spiritual temperature and checking in. Am I optimistic enough? Or am I pessimistic? I'm so tired of that. Of course we're optimistic, and of course we're pessimistic. And those are just feeling states that come and go, and they often depend on who you just talked to and what you had for breakfast. And so to free ourselves from constantly checking in how hopeful we are, and not to be afraid of hopelessness. There's more of a longer riff on it, and I'd like you to hear it. Active hope is not wishful thinking. Active hope is not waiting to be rescued by the Lone Ranger or by some savior. Active hope is waking up to the beauty of life on whose behalf we can act. We belong to this world. The web of life is calling us forth at this time. We've come a long way, and we're here to play our part. With active hope, we realize that there are adventures in store, strengths to discover, comrades to link arms with. Active hope is a readiness to engage, a readiness to discover the strengths in ourselves and in others, a readiness to discover the reasons for hope and the occasions for love, a readiness to discover the size and strength of our hearts, our quickness of mind, our steadiness of purpose, our own authority, our love for life, the liveliness of our curiosity, the unsuspected deep well of patience and diligence, the keenness of our senses, and our capacity to lead. None of these can be discovered in an armchair or without risk. So it was wonderful to be here today because I've been in a period of hopelessness. I become aware again of the four levels of the crisis we face. Let me just name them for you that I learned way back from a Quaker thinker. The first level of the crisis, which is the one we tend to think most about and hear about, is the crisis of carrying capacity. This is exceeding the carrying capacity of your land and waters, of your ecosystems, of your part of the earth, is what has done in the civilizations that have fallen in the past. Cutting down the forest to build your navy and the like. That's just the one. And certainly we're facing that one. That's occurring now. But then the second one is a shocker. It's the level where we see that there, after this one goes, as the others have gone, there won't be another. Beyond Stone Age, because of the how we have depleted the metals and minerals and petroleum of this planet that would be needed for another civilization. Though we'll be pretty good, I expect, in cannibalizing bits and pieces of our the ruins of our cities. The third crisis is the crisis which is posed by the loss of biodiversity, which is proceeding at such a pace that which simplifies the web of life. We're losing in our ecosystems because of the loss of biodiversity, we're losing complexity, and so we're looking toward a future where we cannot be at all sure that complex life forms will be permitted. That's the third. And the fourth level is one that will be brought by the destruction of our oxygen factories that's well underway. What provides us our oxygen? The forests and plankton. You were close. Plankton is over 40% gone. Our photoplankton and phytoplankton in the seas that provide so much of our oxygen and more than that of our trees. And so once that is, we go over the brink there, there'll be just room for anaerobic life forms. So that's an interesting, that can interest me intellectually, but once in a while it hits, and it has been recently. And I think what has made it more brought it forward for me is the utter distractedness of our political powers and the waste of wealth and intelligence of our government in its war-making plans and preparations, with more being spent now on nuclear weapons than at any time during the Cold War, and on the and on repression of dissent and surveillance. And what this does, of course, is what we most need. We most need to be able to see the results of our behaviors. That's known as feedback. And we are, because of our fear of free information, we're causing it, and we're blocking the feedback loops so that we can head over the cliff with fewer people knowing. So there come times, and I'm sure this is true for you guys too, when it seems just awful. Well, that's the way it is. So you just get used to it. But what helps, you could then, what you have another choice, is that you can decide not to think about it and to shut down. Shut down your mind, close your eyes, shut down your heart. And that is so boring. You have, and we have, this exquisite, precious moment to be able to open our eyes and our mind and our heart and our words and our speech and link arms with each other, that we are alive now. And let's not check out before we die. And that's one of the reasons I just love the work that reconnects. First, it was called despair and empowerment work back in the late 70s, early 80s when I started. I wanted to make it so that we could dare to talk about what we, then we might dare to feel it, and then we might dare to know it, so that we could start working together, because we're a highly ingenious species. But we can't be ingenious with something we won't look at. And then it was called deep ecology work, because I found that in the doing of it, we discovered a great shift was happening when we started opening to telling the truth about what we saw and felt and knew was happening to our world. Something amazing happened. And there's a shift in identity. And we began to feel such an incredibly intricate and strong interconnectedness. And that's when the work of Arnie Ness and the deep ecologists came to my mind, came to my notice. And so I thought, oh, this is living proof of that, what Thich Nhat Hanh also calls our interbeing. So we called it deep ecology work for a decade, and then for the last 20 years we've been calling it the work that reconnects. And we moved to that term because deep ecology began to be sort of a conceptual football, particularly among graduate students writing papers, that they would distinguish between social ecology and spiritual ecology and transpersonal ecology and whatever, these different kinds of ecologies. And so, just step aside. I remember I was sitting with my co-author of a book our manual on the book that Sean mentioned, Coming Back to Life, and we said, we've got to get another word. What do we do? And my husband, who loved doing this work, and he did it with me in this country and in Europe, and he took it on his own to the countries of the former Soviet Union, and he said, well, what does it do? And I said, well, you know, it connects the political with the spiritual, it connects the head with the heart, it connects the inner with the outer. And he said, well, it sounds like it just reconnects. And yes, he said, well, you could call it the work that reconnects. And I said, oh. So It's so clunky. And then, well, we couldn't think of a better idea, and you get used to things, you know. It's just, yeah. So I would like to take a moment. I describe this work, what to me is as a form of satyagraha, or truth force. Just as the actions of power holders in the industrial growth society are blocking the feedback loops. Don't publish this about the effects of oil spills, and we say, over, you know, pressures from the oil industry. Or President Obama last week, or what was it, last month, declaring a sanctuary, ocean preserve. And we're all glad about that. But it was, the original plan for it was twice that big. But the tuna industry didn't like that. So somewhere we have to find the power together to say what we know and not be dependent on what the government decides is going to permit us to know. It's revolutionary to see and know and tell the truth. And what is characteristic is that the people who come and get involved in the work that reconnects, they don't hear diagnoses or lectures on the state of the world. And I feel kind of sorry for my fellow lecturer, those on the lecture circuit who are very eloquent about new paradigm thinking. And they talk to people as if the people in the audiences didn't already know it. But I know they already know it. Because in the work that reconnects, we give everyone the chance and we construct these practices where people hear the person they most need to hear. There's the one inside. That's the one each of us most needs to hear. The one we can believe. The person we are. And that's so important because that unblocks the feedback loops. And once you do that, that's really, really almost enough. I'm going to say more about that it's not quite enough, but there's a little bit more we can do to help it. But that's the main thing. That people, because once a system, that's the beauty of living systems, open systems. They are self-organizing, and they are self-organizing toward complexity of beauty and intelligence. And they do that without an external guide. That's the wonder of this phenomenal world as we've come to understand it through our contemporary science, is that it is self-regulating, self-organizing, and complexifying, and self-evolving. So you just need to unblock the feedback loops, and then people will. The system will come, strive for balance and complexity. But I'd say more than that, though, what the truth-telling permits. And I put here, it ignites bodhicitta. Now, some of you will know, of course, that bodhicitta is the word the Buddhist tradition that describes the motivation to act on behalf of the whole, where you as a part act for the sake of the well-being of the whole show. Your people, your planet, or your ecosystem. Now, you can't describe that in a single word in any other way except in that Buddhist Sanskrit term, bodhicitta. And so In this book, we keep that term and are thrilled by finding any ways that we can unleash, because it's a natural capacity in us. It's sort of a function of our Buddha nature. It's because we really are interdependent. So our bodies know that. And the other word that we borrowed was interesting, because my co-author, Chris Johnstone, is not in Buddhist practice. And he was the one who said, let us keep that term. Because it's one word and you have to blah, 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 talk, describe it in English. And the other was bodhisattva. And now that word has become common beyond those who are in Buddhist practice. And there's so many ways that I could describe it. It's the one who cares. It's the one with the boundless heart. It's the one who senses that she, he is part of a larger whole. It's the one who knows there is no private salvation. And this is big. And so bodhicitta is a kind of natural function of the bodhisattva part of us. And in the work that reconnects, then we find ourselves using these terms quite a bit. And going back to the truth-telling, there's another point I'd like to make about the work that reconnects that I just love, and that is that we find this truth-telling happening as we let through other voices. There was a plea today for, and very eloquently, I think it was from Craig Telquist, for the development and fostering, he called fostering the imagination. We do that a lot. There's so much that we can learn from ourselves when we step out of our personal identity and then speak as another being, another person. Sometimes we would have, you know, as you speak from someone who takes the opposing view from you on an issue that you're working on, your adversary. Or we can speak, boy, do you learn a lot then. Or we hear, as we speak truth, using our imagination, speaking on behalf of more than human or non-human beings, as we do in the Council of All Beings. This does really magical work with our sense of identity. It expands our sort of shrunken sense of self that has resulted from so many generations of this hyper-individualism that we're suffering. And people are so good at it. Just the other night at my open sangha, anybody was there? Yeah. Remember, we just had a little time. People got into threesomes. They picked a more than human, another life form or a feature of the natural world. Looked at it in their mind's eye. Let it get real vivid for them. Asked its permission to speak for it, and then proceeded to speak as this other life form. And you're always surprised at how vast is the awareness that is available to us. It also says something about the life itself that we have are part of. And it's fun. And funny, too, often. I saw an email this morning from a fellow who was there and whom I know just slightly, and he was telling someone else, been copying me, that he had been a cloud that night. Remember, he spoke about it. and how amazing it was to experience himself as a cloud, changing forms and kind of constantly impermanent, constantly in process, letting the light through or blocking it, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's so good to remember that our very capacity to experience and express this testifies to that knowing is already in us. We wouldn't be able to describe it if we were only limited to the literal experiences of ourself in this bag of skin. That there's a vast belonging that becomes evident to us, or an interexistence. Yeah. Another thing I would like to mention to you is that when we tell the truth about the condition of our world and what it feels like for us to get word of or to see with our own eyes in our cities and the smog, the homelessness on the streets, when we hear about what's happening to the water, to the climate, when we can detect it with our senses, when we've seen, et cetera, et cetera. I used to, when I began this work, am I talking awfully fast? I'm feeling rushed because there's so much I want to say and you're so precious to me. Ah! Should I just take a deep breath?
Whatever you need.
Thank you. I used to just start people off with, oh, now you can come together, and now you can speak your anguish, your planetary anguish over what's happening. This is a place for you to really come clean with it. This is a place you don't have to hide it. You can just say it. And there's structures, as I've said, particular that you don't ever just say, well, talk. No, but you structure things. So this make it much easier and swifter, because I don't want to sit around forever waiting till somebody gets to the point. So it's impatience in service to structure. But I found that things are so dicey now that I found that in the 90s I was beginning to open the work with asking for the good news and letting people express what they love. And so that became more and more part of the work. And we began to see the work as a spiral. We call it a spiral simply because of the four stations in it. You go around and round, and it's different each time. Or go around just once in a workshop, or more than once, or what have you, on your own when you're facing something. And that the first station in that spiral is gratitude. This helps ground us, because it's shaky now. The situation we're in, is so dicey, and it takes a certain deliberate valor to move into direct expression. So it feels good to ground it in giving thanks for life. And that in itself has been a remarkable and unfolding revelation to me. I have come to understand over the last about 20, 25 years of doing this as deliberately at the beginning, But growing in more and more, how foundational it is for us now. And it may be because, Renee, of what you brought up about shame, that we're not worthy to even be glad for anything. And in that, so we found so many ways, but I realized, of course, then, that gratitude is the first act in every spiritual path, in every religion. It's that how religions get started. It's sort of that primal, wow, get a load of this. Woo-hoo! Fingers, hair, trees. Oh, it's air, I can breathe. Woo! And it's just, and to let wonder and acceptance in right from the start. And it's our birthright. And I've come to the point where even if we never get any farther than that, in a way it's almost enough. Because the gratitude helps you see how much you love this life, how much it is blessing you moment by moment. And you get awfully good at it. You're just, your mind soars. People just love it so. And then you feel that sort of like water coming up from the floor, the grief. The grief is right there. And the grief is something that you can manage and you can look at. Because the gratitude says that it's okay for you to be here. And that you are blessed. And that you're steadied enough to be able to see. And that you need to see. And you need to open your eyes and voice to what you're already feeling. So you're not asking people to start feeling bad, but simply to say how it is. How it is for you. How it is for you as a young woman or a young man to hesitate and go into psychic turmoil about whether even to have a child. So many young people are facing, you know this, that it's come to that. Yeah. So, and it's been quite wonderful to open to what has been there all along that I didn't really get, which is the great gift of the Aboriginal people of this continent, and really Aboriginal people, Indigenous people, Earth, worldwide, and especially in my home state, where I've learned so much, New York, from the Six Nation Confederacy of the Haudenosaunee, also known as the Iroquois. And that capacity to wait and pause and speak in any way that comes to you, the word, what they call the words that come before all else. That's what, as you probably know, that's what how they speak of the Thanksgiving. The words that come before all else. Oh, my friends, that should come before all else for us, even when we're on the brink of, in the process of destroying so much of our world, that we give thanks for the intricacy and beauty and for the life that we're blessed with that has been pure gift. And I've seen that in, for the elders who have become my teachers in this and exemplars of the Onondaga and Mohawk nations particularly, but of all the Haudenosaunee, that these words that come before all else are like oxygen. That's just like the ground beneath their feet. And that those who have not been destroyed by the humiliations and the massacres and the corruptions and the meanness we visited upon them, that they've held to this, that they stand with certain moral intact and nobility and dignity. I keep going like this because it feels like a moral backbone, that even though they've been through a Holocaust, I never knew how bad was the way we've been treating them until I began learning in the recent years. And then I've thought, they've been through a Holocaust and we're going to go through one too. We are going through harder times than this. You know that. And so for we too, they show us how by opening to life and having the strength and nobility to give thanks for it will keep us in our dignity and our full moral capacity. So then in the spiral of the work that reconnects, there's the gratitude, and then what happens? Then we're grounded enough to be able to express and turn to what we've been experiencing all along to recognize it. The grief that is there. Even if you're brimming with optimism and thinks everything is going to be all right, there's still the knowledge of the losses. The losses are beyond the telling. So the grief is there. A sorrow so deep. And there's dread and fear as well. When we let ourselves get close enough to it. And there's outrage. There's anger that it has come to this, that we are doing this to each other and to our world and to the other beings. And there's the overwhelm. And so this is a place where that gets honored, and we call that next stage befriending or honoring our pain for the world. And here the tantric nature of adversity that you can see and that I'm most familiar with from Tantra of Tibetan Buddhism is to see how each of these elements of the aspects of the anguish of being alive now grows from as an expression of something wonderful and positive, essential to our life. That the sorrow that we express, the losses, is actually an expression of our love. You mourn, you mourn what you love. And you begin to experience that, that you're mourning your grief for the world and your love for the world are like two sides of the same coin. They're inseparable. And if you try to pave over the pain because it hurts or pathologize it or drug it, then you're losing touch with that great love, which as you experience it is a sign of the great reciprocity at the heart of the universe, that it's a two-way street. That as you're loving your world, you find as you allow yourself to love your world, it's loving you back. This is there for us to discover like jewels in this time of darkness. And that when we turn to express our rage and our anger, and we'll do it for once, because it's goddamn horrible what's happening to our world, then we are also in that rage. We're saying, what is that really? Is it ill will or malice? No. No, it is not. It is our passion for justice. So we find we can honor that too. We do this for those. How many of you have done the truth mandala? Yeah, we did it in our class. Yeah. Do it in a lot of the workshops. It's wonderful. When you dare to speak your fear, when you dare to speak your fear, what are you doing? You're showing courage in a fear-phobic society. Our culture is so afraid of fear. Our culture is so afraid of fear that it's shut us up. Despite all that we know, but despite the mountains of evidence about our complicity of our government in the events of 9/11, we are so afraid of what people will say about us or look at us cross-eyed for bringing it out in public. It's infantilized us. It's made us obedient and isolated because we haven't had the courage to speak our fear. So we get exercise for that in the work that reconnects. And rituals help greatly. There was quite a bit of talk today about safe containers for our grief for the world. For our, that wasn't the word that was used. What was it? What word did we use for that today? Any rate, but ritual is a great container. And it makes us place that's confined and separate from the rest of your life so that you can say, here, I can speak this. I can speak in this voice. I can allow this dimension of my life to come, our common life to come to expression and utterance. That's beautiful. So beautiful. And then after the honoring our pain for the world, it's as if then there's a turning and we realize how vast really is our belonging. That this painful feelings are actually expressions of something so beautiful and exquisite about our interexistence with each other. And so then we have in the third part of the spiral, we call it seeing with new eyes. And there we do deep ecology work, Council of All Beings. We do deep time work. We speak on behalf of or to the ancestors. We harvest the gifts of the ancestors. We travel by the power of our intention and imagination to a point outside of time where we can talk with the future ones as well. And they have a lot to say. Because the future is in us. One of my teachers, the great nuclear radiologist, Rosalie Bertell, said, every being who will ever live on Earth is here now. Get that. Every being who will ever live on Earth is here now. Where? In our ovaries and in our gonads and in our DNA. The future is in us. And we can bring it to expression. And it has such help for us. Such clear companionship and counsel and humor as well. And so then as we come around to the fourth station in that spiral of the work that reconnects, we come to what we call going forth. Where we harvest what really struck us, what really became part of us in the journey so far. And then see how we want to apply it in our lives, in our communities, in our work. What are we uniquely suited for? Our situation invites us to, and then we help each other look at it. And we, as we go forth, giving more and more attention to how we can sustain this active hope, not just when we're hanging out together doing this work, but in our daily lives. And essential to that, it's to me, is, and what we're all invited to right now, is a linking arms with our brothers and sisters, our coming out of hiding, our coming out of isolation, and making common cause with them in the great turning, that transition to a life-sustaining society. And it can take many forms. It can be part of a holding action where you're engaged in resistance to slow down the destruction of the industrial growth society in so many ways, politically, legislatively, legally, with regulatory laws, or even with direct civil disobedience. There's that. Then there's the dimension of crafting and working together to craft the structures and ways of doing things for a life-sustaining society. There are new ways that of holding the land, new ways of growing the food, new ways of distributing it, new ways of solving conflict, new ways of measuring prosperity, etc. The new approaches to life, the new behaviors and actions that people are undertaking are dizzyingly manifold in this time. They just aren't on television much or on the headlines of the papers. They're not receiving much attention by corporate-controlled media. But, oh, they're vast. And so this is what's awaiting us as we claim our for our eco-psychological health, as we claim our ecological self, is that we sustain it by working for the ongoingness of life on Earth. And then that third dimension of it, after holding actions, changing the foundations of the structures, then what we were doing so much today, which is shift in consciousness, getting a whole new perception of who we are and our relationship to this land, to this living planet. And it just can change everything as we realize that we are an inseparable part of it. And that as we act, it's not just our strength, our little stash of skills and smarts that we can depend on, but there's a tidal force of love in action that is coming through. It feels like it's coming through from the earth. You know what I mean, don't you? It's like grace. When I was a little girl in my Christian girlhood, I was so that grace comes from God. And that's wonderful. It adds to your little stash of whatever you think you have. But now I see more and more all around us that grace comes from other people. Grace comes from those we are working to assist. Grace can come from a forest under attack or already mown down. Grace can come from the flying geese over a city sunk and stinking in its own excrescence. did that come from? When I think of how we really, really need to band together in teams and work together, that for something beyond our skin, you know, and whether you're, even if you fail, it can be so, you learn so much and it can be such a joy. I was in a period of great despair for the future. I was almost speechless with it back, gosh, at the start of this work. And I had the good sense somehow to join a little group for three other people to make a people's lawsuit against the Virginia Electric Power Company, which was racking the fuel rods too close together illegally, that so it risks a critical event. They get to, and boy, that was so life changing. I learned so much, and we had such a good time. And I love respecting people. Don't you love to respect people? Oh, and we'd joke, and they're smart, and they were all just half my age, and just in law school still and really working. And we had such a good time. And I wouldn't change that for everything. And you know what? We failed. But I'm so glad we did it. Because I learned something. What I learned then is that I love to be in a beautiful moral battle. And it's so much fun. And I loved admiring my teammates. And what I learned then is informed all my life. So it doesn't depend on success. The great turning will depend not so much on what we're doing, but the fact that we don't give up. Fall down, get up. Fall down, get up. You fail, you don't let that stop you. Just come back. I've been struck by in the early Sangha, when the Buddha was still alive, he got people into groups, and we think of it as little monasteries all neat with sort of like in the Christian model in the Europe. But it wasn't quite that. But these were people who, because it was a time of great unrest. There was monarchies were growing where people had been ruling their, taking care of themselves in a quite a, by meeting and making decisions by consensus in tribal little gatherings of, which they called sanghas. And so they were being sucked into the cities in this period of economic change, growing surplus of rice, more trade, two monarchies rising, hierarchies coming in, great disparities of wealth. All this was happening. And people were losing their sense of who they were, that they had been, their ways had been dictated to them or familiar to them over many, many, many generations, and they knew their way. And suddenly it was like the rug was being pulled out from under them, and they were flocking to the cities, and they didn't know whether did you start fighting each other, or is what kind of competition, and what's this, where can I, what's happening to the work I do? And it was at this time, with all this change and unrest, that these sanghas began forming, and where people could experience a new way of being that didn't fit in with the centralized monarchical power. And in this was the original Sangha, but it happened in little pockets, settlements. And so they were socially inclusive at a time when caste and class and wealth differentiations were growing. They had private property. There was no private property. It was a gift economy. It was sharing. Nobody had their, except you have your robe and a bowl, and then you make your decisions in common, and you include everybody. The runaway slave, the lowest class person, often of darker skin, because caste system was already developing then. And you make decisions together. Well, I love reading about this, and I'm thinking I might love to give a course in it if there was a demand for it. Because I think that this kind of thing may be happening now, but we could encourage it happening, that we could find that we could cultivate communities of practice, where we belong to each other. Maybe you don't have to live together right away, but where you practice truth-telling and sharing and inclusivity and being open, very open to and articulate and about what's happening to the world, practicing the great art of truth-telling. I think there are so many things I wanted to say to you. I do want to tell you that we were talking today about how you can make it okay with people to tell, for them to speak their deepest truth or distress about what's happening to our world, and not repress it. So how do you do that? So that was a question for me early on when I saw how powerful the work that Reconnects was, and it's under its earlier names as well, where people could. So I thought, how can, you know, I know that most people wouldn't be caught dead in a workshop. So what do you do about all those people who wouldn't be caught dead in a workshop? And so I thought, what is the most important thing that happens? And it's the people here themselves speak the truth of what they see and know is happening to the world. I said, okay, how can you do that outside of a workshop? It won't be at a dinner party. And it won't be as you're sitting, you know, passing the day and the time of day in your office or your workplace. So where would it be? And we began what we called the Parsifal exercise. So to explain to you, Parsifal was the name of a knight in King Arthur's court. And this was described in the legend of the Holy Grail. It was the last myth to come up in Western civilization and around the 12th century. And in this great long epic, which appeared, it's about the time of the Crusades, interestingly enough, both in German and in French and in English, Parsifal was out. He was the sort of the epitome of the knight, a great knight of the Round Table. He was gorgeous, of course, and he could knock anybody. He won every fight. And He wasn't all that smart. He was sort of like a little Abner. But that's a generational comment. Most of you know what I mean by that. And so he was out on a quest one day, sort of looking for a maiden to rescue from a tower or something. And he suddenly found himself in a bleakest landscape. It was desolate. How did he get here? Nothing was growing. The whole land was barren. It was appalling. And he finally sees they're on a lake and it's a little boat. Is it two figures fishing, one in royal robes, and he calls out and says, "Where can I find lodging?" And the one in royal robes directs him to the castle, and he follows the directions. Then he comes to the castle of the Fisher King. Well, they seem to be expecting him. They help him down and untake off the armor and usher him in, give him a nice place to chamber to stay, and bring him in to a great banquet hall. And there, on at the front, on a kind of hammock bed, is lying the Fisher King, the same guy he'd seen out on the lake. And he is sick and wounded. He said he's been wounded in the groin and is in agony, and it smells bad too. And so Parsifal goes up and acknowledges him, bows to him because he's the host. But he notices that nobody's acting as if anything is out of order. No one is talking about the land being desolate, so nothing's growing, or that the king also has lost the powers of regeneration and is suffering. So he's curious and wants to know, but his mother had told him, "Good knight doesn't ask questions." So he keeps his lip buttoned, unfortunately, because he didn't say anything about it or ask anything. He wakes up the next morning, the castle has disappeared. Nothing's changed. Somehow he gets up on his horse by himself, gets into his armor, and finally wanders out. Takes him a long time to find his way back. And he is feeling terribly troubled. And even more so when at the welcome dinner to welcome him back at the King Arthur's court, everybody say, "Oh, hooray, Parsifal's back." In comes this witch-like creature, very famous in literature from then on, Kundry. She's brilliant, and she's ugly, and with fangs like a boar, and bristles on her face, and sumptuous clothes, and she excoriates Parsifal by saying, "You are the sorriest excuse of a knight I've ever seen. Shame on you. You were able, you were at the castle of the Fisher King. You saw the suffering and you did nothing to say anything about it. You didn't even inquire. You will never amount to anything." And he feels great remorse and shame and is cast into a despair and a depression that lasts for quite a while. I won't tell you all that happens in between, though I'd like to because it's fascinating, but I need to tell you what he does. He finally finds Kundry. He says, I've been trying to get back to the castle of the Fisher King. I want to make up for my failure, but I can't find it. I can't find the wasteland." And she says, "I'll show you the way." So she points and she gets him there, and then he continues. He finds the castle. He again is greeted and helped down. He walks in to the banquet hall, same as before, except the king is yet sicker. And he goes straight to the king, kneels by his hammock bed, and says, "My lord, what aileth thee?" At that moment, with those words, color comes back to the cheeks of the king, and he rises from his bed, health instantly restored. And when he looks through the window, Parsifal can see that leaves are appearing on the trees and green grasses on the ground, that the land also has been restored because someone has broken the silence and because someone has dared to ask a compassionate question. Well, that gave me the idea. And we then proceeded to do the Parsifal exercise. And sometimes we do it out of a workshop or something afterwards on its own. I'm gesticulating a lot. I could try holding my... And I've combined it with voter registration, going door to door. Now, what we do is this is a way to engage people on the street, but you don't ask, "What aileth thee?" But you can say, "Excuse me, I wonder if I could have a few..." I'm doing a public opinion survey, and I'm wondering if you could answer a few questions. I'm not selling anything, but I would value your opinion. And just three or four questions. And so usually when people are in a place where they're not hurrying off, they're eager to, or ready to do this. So as I said, laundromat, bus station, train station, but sometimes on the street, and even door knocking. In the early days, we did that quite a bit. It's good, and I've done that too, right there in the sunset was really great. And you combine it, you can combine it with other things. And so a question would be, excuse me, I'd like to just, what do you consider the greatest problem facing humanity in this time? Oh, is that so? Oh. And do you think it's getting better or worse? Oh. Do you think, would you say that this is something that an individual like you or me can do anything about? Oh. That's a very good question, because then whatever they say, like, "No, there's nothing you can do about it," then that works in their minds. Is it true? Is it true we can't do anything about it? Or if they say, "Yes, there is," then you can draw that out. So that from the beginning, what struck us all in this was how bleak, how even desperate were people's views. Once they had a chance, these are things people hadn't asked them. Has anyone asked you this? And they're safe just talking with one other person or two, max. And when we, sometimes I would add just as few, is this something you can talk about with your family or at work? Uh-huh. Is there another question you'd like me to ask you? That's a great one. And then so that's about four or five, and then we close with, "What gives you hope?" And so I was thinking of often writing a book about it, because the answers were so great, and it was so moving. But I've had I think of the people who say, all right now, dearie, would you just come back in an hour? My husband will be home then. I want him to answer these questions. No, there's nothing I can do about it. Wait a minute. I can do what you're doing. I can ask people questions. Where can I go to get trained to do that? So this is just a little bit of a teaser for you, that there are countless ways that you can play around with giving people the chance to, and they, in every case, there was an eagerness to speak at last about this. And I remember here in San Francisco, though we've done it in Sydney and Hamburg and Berlin and London and just about in Boston and just about name it. But just down here, I remember I was door knocking with voter registration, and there was a high school teacher. Everything he said was of utmost bleakness and despair. He said, oh, God, the bomb is already dropped. He was a high school teacher. And the future these kids are facing, and they're so demoralized already, and they're taking it out on their own bodies and on each other. And I said, is there anything an individual like me? Oh, really? He says, look what happened to Martin Luther King. Look what happened to Jesus. Look what happened to Malcolm X. You know, you'd stick your neck out. And so then I was about to go, and he said, well, don't you have another question? And I said, well, I do. I thought it was almost pointless to ask, but I did. So I said, well, the last question is, what gives you hope? He said, boy, you really ask questions. What gives me hope? Wait, don't go, don't go. I'll tell you what gives me hope, that somebody cares enough to ask. So I want to stop, but there's so much to say. I need to say that a graduate of this eco-psychology, East-West psychology, here has written a book, Ziba Woodbury, if any of you know him. He's getting it published, and he is talking about dealing with climate change. He's calling it climate grief, using the stages of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's response to challenges, and from a denial to bargaining to anger and depression, and finally acceptance. And so it's this acceptance doesn't mean that you're sure that this is the last chapter for complex life forms. Acceptance is that you see that it could be, and that you're not editing, you're not putting on blinders, you're not editing out what you're allowing yourself to experience. And that, and in that, there is this acceptance of uncertainty, and there's quite a bit of talk about that. Wasn't that great today, the talk about, and almost everybody's on their lips was this, not only the wisdom, but almost the beauty of uncertainty, because that's the most creative place to be, that kind of razor's edge where you don't know whether it's over or whether you can do something and whether it's going to be okay, and it summons all your attention. And really, we love that. We love being in a situation where great concentration is required, great absorption. And it does. And that and it keeps us So it's the only place where you can be as brave and as creative as you really want to be, and you can be, is on that knife edge of uncertainty. And that, I was thinking today that acceptance that he asked for us, and he thinks that he started out writing this book. He's an environmental lawyer, among other things, and he spent a lot of time dealing with ecological struggles, issues in the courtroom. But he finds that where the population, percentage-wise, is more in acceptance than he had expected. That's the clues he's getting. That more of us are in acceptance of this diciness of this time, the uncertainty, that it could go either way, that we're not fighting it. And this is a wonderful place to be, because then, you know, you're thinking, I'm myself thinking today, this, you get to a point where with that uncertainty, it's okay to die. That you can still be so glad you were given a chance to be a human being in Earth and at this time. And you're not going to get petulant and say, well, I'll only like it if it's going on forever. Well, it's now. It's all you got now. But if that's all you have, but if you're going to die, then I think of what we'd want to do if we really knew it was our last hours. What we'd open the prisons, the factory farms, the rivers. How do we want to die? Let's at least release the prisoners. Let's at least think you can think about the things we want to do in our last gesture. So now a closing, I have a few lines of poetry, and you know by whom. And then I've asked Chris Giffen to sing you a song that has come to mean so much to me now, and you're going to love it. So here are the three things. One is from Rainer Maria Rilke, and in his ninth Duino elegy, he sings, it's like his singing, his love for the earth. Oh, earth, I've belonged to you since before I was born, and I know I can trust the death you will bring. So I wanted you to have that quote, that line. And then there's from the Book of Hours, and it was written, he wrote this like over 100 years ago, and he was 23 years old. But he sensed that the 20th century just opening was going to bring horrific losses and technologies that were and to world wars and the death camps and bombers and nukes, and he knew it would be, that it could be, he sensed, he didn't know what way, but at any rate, here is, he's talking to the sacred living earth. Dear darkening ground, you've endured so faithfully the walls we built. Please grant the cities one more hour, and give the churches and cloisters too. And those that labor, let their toil still grip them for another 5 hours or seven before you become widening wilderness and woods and water in that inconceivable hour when you take back your name from all things. Just give me a little more time. I just want a little more time because I am going to love the things as no one has thought to love them until they're real and right and worthy of you. So that's an idea for you. You have a little time. He doesn't sigh. I just need a little more time because I'm going to get a grant from the Guggenheim, or I've got this. I'm going to finish my dissertation, or because I'm going to love the things. And that's what each of us can do. Each of us has capacity to love something better almost than anybody else. There are ways we know that your life has given you to love this world. Or aspects of this world. That's what you do when time seems to be running out. And the last poem is one you've heard from me. Anybody's heard me before standing right here. I've said it before. It's the last sonnet in the Sonnets to Orpheus. And we translated that, Anita and I, just as we were going into Iraq in 2003, and our hearts were so heavy and rebellious and dark. And this carried us through. And you can sort of see the shift there from the pain to knowing your oneness with the sacred living body of Earth. Quiet friend who has come so far. Feel how your breathing makes more space around you. Let this darkness be a bell tower, and you the bell. And as you ring, what batters you becomes your strength. So move back and forth into the changes. What's it like, this intensity of pain? Oh, if the drink is bitter, turn yourself to wine. In this uncontainable night, be the mystery at the crossroads of your senses, the meaning discovered there. And if the world has ceased to hear you, say, say to the silent earth, I flow, and to the rushing water speak, I am. One with the earth, one with the waters, each of us.
An invocation of healing to end, and this is a song by Leonard Cohen, one of my Canadian mentors. At least as of late, he seems to get wiser as he gets older.
Gather up the brokenness, bring it to me now. vows you never dared to vow. The splinters that you carry, the cross you left behind, come healing of the body, come healing of the mind. And let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn, come healing of the spirit, come healing of the limb. Behold the gates of mercy in arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace. O solitude of longing, where love has been confined, come healing of the body, come healing of the mind. Troubled dust concealing an undivided love, the heart beneath is teaching to the broken heart above. And let the heavens falter, let the earth proclaim, come healing of the altar, come healing of the name. O longing of the branches to lift the little bud, O longing of the arteries to purify the blood, and let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn, come healing of the spirit, come healing of the limb. And let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn, come healing of the spirit, come healing of the limb.
Dear Bodhisattvas, we're not doing any Q&A now.